Hello, I'm Dan Masterson, host of Strategy Talk, where we take a unique view of world events. We report news as history. With me today is the editor of StrategyPage.com and well-known military author, Jim Dunnigan. Associate editor and syndicated columnist, Austin Bay, also joins us.
Welcome, Jim and Austin. Last week in Geneva, a deal was placed in front of the Iranians to ease some of the sanctions and get some things in place for some compromise on what they could do with their nuclear facilities. France and Israel were quite upset about it. What's your take on the whole thing, Jim?
The Iranians are losing over $100 million a day. Because of the embargo, and they want that money back. Simple as that.
Well, that's pretty simple. Now, why did they not take the deal, Jim, then when it was laid in front of them?
Well, as Austin pointed out, they also want the bomb. They want both. And that's going to require some adroit negotiating.
Okay. Now, one of the things that was reported in the press was that some of the sanctions, well, not the sanctions themselves have been eased, but the United States government has not been going after the shell companies quite as aggressively. Had you heard that, Austin?
I read that, Dan, and the thing is I can't confirm that. I've read it. I've read it in a couple of places. I think Jim would know more about that on the economic side of the house than I would. I have suspected that there were negotiation carrots to encourage the Iranians to come to the table being offered. And as Jim pointed out, the Iranians are hurting economically. Now, the sanctions bite deeply into the senior members of the regime because it's a kleptocracy. It's crooked. Understand that their economic failure is due to the failure of the Islamic Revolution. It's a mess, and that's so a lot of their economic failure. The reason it fails is they're run by theocrats. They're not run by people who know how to run an economy. Ideology and power, their power comes before economic success, economic progress. But as Jim said, and as I've mentioned, they want a bomb. They've wanted a bomb at least since the early 1990s. We know they've had a program going since the mid-1990s, and there were indications that they were interested in developing a program even prior to that, back in the 1980s. It's worth hitting the history on this is because what was going on in the 1980s, Dan? Iran-Iraq War, the huge war when Saddam Hussein invaded Khuzestan, or Arabistan, as he called it, the Iranian province right on the Iraqi border. And Saddam made no secret about his desire to get a bomb. The Iranians believed that Saddam was, even after Desert Storm, the Iranians weren't alone. We did as well. Everybody believed it, even some of Saddam's own people, that he'd retained special weapons, chemical and nuclear weapons, and the idea was that if the nuclear program's on hold, Saddam wants to be able to restart it. So the Iranians, one of their reasons, is the Iraqis, whoever's living on the other side of the Mesopotamia, their traditional enemy. If the Iraqis are going to have one, we're going to have one to balance it out. Plus, there's also that global vision that the Ayatollah Khomeini had. He was going to lead an Islamic revolution where the Shias were going to the power of Iran and the Shia theocracy was going to lead the Islamic revolution. And so they've got a bomb. They've got something to threaten Persian Gulf Arab states, to use to threaten them, as well as the Israelis. So there's the history of it. There's the reason they want it. And as Jim said, they want the economic goodies as well. And my bottom line take is this is more of the same we have seen since the mid-1990s, which is stalling and talking and wheedling. And I believe they see a couple of the Western negotiators as very vulnerable, very eager, way too eager to make a deal. I mean John Kerry, U.S. Secretary of State, and the Obama administration. And we'll encourage you to take the sanctions off. And by the way, we'll promise to reduce our fissile material stocks. Well, they've made a lot of promises, and they never kept them, Dan, you know?
Yeah. Jim, you had talked a little bit. One of the things that I think a lot of people don't understand is the level that the uranium needs to be refined to for a nuclear weapon. And I thought one of the things that was happening with the proposal that the United States had put on the table was that some people would not understand what Iran needs to do to actually get a bomb, and what the difference between refining to a 20% level versus something less than that is. You'd written a little bit about that.
Yeah, Iran has one nuclear power plant. It just went online. It was built by the Russians. We've written about that. And it requires, I think it's 250 pounds of low-grade nuclear material a year. This is usually pellets of, refined uranium in a metal tube that is put into water, and it heats up and it creates steam and that creates electricity. I mean, that's basically a nuclear power plant. The problem is the Iranians have bought sufficient processing equipment, mostly the centrifuges, that concentrate the uranium-235, that's the hot stuff, that creates heat or a boom for a bomb, to create far more fuel each year than they need for their power plant. And, of course, the question arose early on, why are you doing this? There's no money to be made in selling nuclear fuel because maybe there is in the next decade, but for the last 20 years, the world's nuclear plants have been operating off fairly cheap, reprocessed nuclear material from Russian nuclear weapons and some American nuclear weapons, mostly Russian. But anyway, there are several countries that are already producing nuclear fuel for, sale, export, under tightly controlled, conditions. None of it's going to bomb makers. So, the question arose, a lot of people, as Austin just explained, it's no secret the Iranians have wanted a bomb, and this became even more urgent as they were slapped with more and more arms embargoes. They were unable to buy weapons, even from traditional merchants of death who will sell to anybody like China and Russia. Even they back off from supplying. Well, more Russia than China's backing off. Be that as it may, the Iranians quickly realized that if they want a decisive military weapon, and they can't have a conventional force, which they've had the most powerful military force in the region for thousands of years, like 5,000 years or so, nuclear weapons would do it. And even before the religious revolution, the takeover of Iran in 79 by the Islamic conservatives, the Shah, who ruled before that, he was trying to create a nuclear weapon, as were a lot of countries, in the 60s and 70s. And the Iranians had a hard time because, as Austin pointed out, during the 1980s, they were preoccupied with the war with Iraq. And then in the 90s, they were rebuilding. But as part of that rebuilding process, they restarted their nuclear weapons, or nuclear power, as they call it. They would never admit they were developing nuclear weapons, but you ask people on the street in Iran, and they say, yes, we need nuclear weapons. Iranians take it for granted. So this is either a mass delusion that put something special in the water, or most Iranians are indeed what they seem to be, and that is, they like the idea, they approve of the idea of having nuclear weapons. And they understand, again, you know, a lot of Westerners go into and out of Iran. They talk to Iranians. There are, millions of Iranians in exile who stay in touch with their kin back in Iran. And they all say the same thing. Yes, of course, nuclear weapons. We're getting nuclear weapons. So no matter what the media might say or diplomats might say, Iran wants nuclear weapons. And by all intents and purposes, they are producing nuclear weapons because by their own admission, they have created nuclear fuel at the 20%, purity level, shall we say, 20% U-235. Now, for nuclear power, you only need 3.5% minimum, 5% is sort of the sweet spot. And most of their nuclear fuel, they've already produced, which is far in excess, like I said, of what they need, is at least 5%, and a lot of it is 20%. Now, they give several reasons for why they have fuel up to the 20% level, but nobody believes them. They're basically, in fact, there's fear that they've already gone beyond 20%. You got to get to about 50% before it's suitable for a nuclear weapon. Now, it obviously, if they have enough centrifuges to produce more fuel, more power plant fuel than they need, it's not quite enough to mass produce, nuclear fuel. If the current intelligence is, if they get all the centrifuges they are known to have bought or put together going, they could produce enough fuel once they're in full production with all these centrifuges to create one or two bombs a year. And this is worrisome because that's far in excess. They need a couple of dozen power plants, to take up the output from that many centrifuges. So it's basically mathematics, simple math, actually. What are they doing with all this nuclear material, especially the very rich nuclear material that is not really suitable for a power plant? It's overkill for a power plant, but it's what you need for a nuclear weapon. And that's the basic conundrum. I mean, the Iranians, as Austin points out, they're playing games. They've always been playing games, and they do that because they know games work. They've been playing games on their neighbors and their enemies for centuries. It's nothing new, except to Americans. Because Americans still have this tendency to look at the rest of the world as Americans who talk funny and have some strange customs. But you go around the United States, you find some strange customs. So Americans kind of accept that. In fact, they also know in different parts of America, people talk funny. Go to Maine or go down to Alabama, and you'll hear English spoken ways you didn't think it was possible. So this is what you have to understand. The Iranians accept the fact that they need nuclear weapons. And the world basically hit them where they hurt when in mid 2012 they implemented a set of trade restrictions that made it very difficult for them to sell their oil. And now their oil sales are only half, about 1 million barrels a day instead of 2.2 million barrels a day. And so do the math, $100 a barrel. It's a big money. And that oil income is like 80-90% of their foreign exchange. So if they want to buy foreign goods, they need foreign currency. They can't get it. Because, again, as Austin pointed out, I think you might have brought up, one of the things that was bounced around at the last round of negotiations last week was to ease up on some of the banking restrictions, because that's what really hurt them. Because for a long time, the Iranians got around a lot of the embargo restrictions by finding crooked bankers. Well, we finally caught up with the crooked bankers. Actually, a lot of people, even regulators, were looking the other way. So, well, that's no big deal. That's just politics. That's diplomacy. That means nothing to us. Well, the U.S. government finally said, no, now it means something. If you want to keep your jobs, if you don't want to be indicted, just mention Patriot Act, in the same sentence, whatever you want done, and people suddenly get moving. So there is something to be said for fear. And the Iranians want to get rid of a lot of this stuff because it's basically, it's damaged their smuggling, their illegal importation system they've set up over the last 20 years. They simply can't get stuff because they can't pay for it. Same thing with North Korea. hit them in the banking system because that's where it really hurts. So what the Iranians are willing to accept right now in return for some meaningless concessions is just ease up on a lot of these rules so they can cheat again. They consider it unfair that we've made it so tight that they got no room to play. And that's what people are. And, of course, as Austin pointed out, the Obama really wants a win. That's why he's leaning on the, as we point out, strategy page. That's why he's been we've been going through the drill of trying to get peace talks between the Israelis and the Palestinians, even though the Palestinians are very publicly on record as wanting Israel destroyed, not negotiated with. Again, that's this thing, you know, you can sell that to Americans, but people in the rest of the world are scratching their head saying, you know, what is going on here? You know, the Palestinians have no interest in peace. But there you go. I mean, that's the world of diplomacy for you. It's strange out there.
Yeah, you know, talking about the Iranian people, the Ayatollahs have really tried to make this a nationalistic thing. I don't know if you remember, Jim and Austin, I think we posted the video up on strategy page, but they had a couple of years ago when they refined some stuff and they were very excited about their success, that they had a whole pageant where they had people dancing around the supposed uranium that had been refined, and it was very bizarre, very un-American.
I know, but it was also very revealing. Because like I keep saying, and we keep saying in strategy page, most Iranians support nuclear weapons. And most diplomats are very well aware of that. And any Iranian government that started down the road to developing nuclear weapons and backed off would be extremely unpopular. And the one thing the religious dictatorship, which is now, it's become less and less popular over the last two decades, they want to stay in power, because if they're out of power, a lot of them are dead, you know, and their family fortunes evaporate. It's a big tragedy for these people. I'm not saying you should feel sorry for them, but look at it from their point of view. It's important that we stay in power. And one way they stay in power is they and the family stole a lot of the oil income. They, more so than most other corrupt oil countries like Nigeria, for example, they passed a lot of it around. That's why the Saudis were not affected by the Arab Spring. I mean, it's a religious dictatorship in Saudi Arabia. But there was no revolution because the Saudis made everybody's lives better, and that makes a big difference. And that's the same thing in Iran. Iran is actually a very modern country. You know, they have super highways, they have a lot of, you know, Western type, you know, stores and, consumer goods and what have you, education. I mean, there's the ridiculous business with the religious police telling women to wear longer skirts and, you know, not show their hair and nonsense like that, which annoys a lot of Iranians, but not enough Iranians want another civil war or another war period, to settle the matter. And so they're alive. The Iranians are more inclined to cope or immigrate, which many have done. But they want their nukes, and they are basically determined to have them. And if the government, which is basically laid it on the line, they've said, look, we are not, as a matter of fact, not as something we're going to admit to the foreigners, but as far as people on the street are concerned, the government is developing nuclear weapons. And if the government suddenly admits that, oh, yes, we are, but now we're going to stop, and actually stops, they're in big trouble.
Right. Austin, you had something you were going to say?
Yeah, there's I would, first of all, a little bit cheeky here, but I can recommend a couple of books that talk about the way the theocracy plays and pushes Iranian nationalism, the 1996 and 2008 edition of A Quick and Dirty Guide to War by James F. Dunnigan and Austin Bay. It does talk about how they do that to prop up the regime, and they play upon the Iranian people's sense of pride and nationhood and the roots going back to 500 BC, 600 BC. I mean, that's part and parcel of it, which is kind of curious when you look at some of the Sunni Muslims that would make the argument all history prior to Muhammad's revelation is irrelevant. Well, it's really not functionally among Sunnis either, but that's certainly not in the Shia regime in Iran. Now, let me pick up on a couple of things that that Jim said. I'm leaving the banking portion to Jim's analysis. 2004, the attacks on Iraqi oil infrastructure. There was very good reason. My own conclusion was this is part of what was going on, Iranian strategy, believed that the Iranians had a real interest in pushing both Saddam's remnant supporters and Al-Qaeda and other Salafist extremist groups inside Iraq to hit that infrastructure, not simply because damaging the interim Iraqi government, but heck, that raises oil prices. And the Iranians play that game all the time. Well, there have been a number of things, Dan, trends over the last 4 or 5 years. Natural gas, fracking for natural gas, and the has provided a larger energy buffer, not just in the United States, but in other places around the world. And there's pressure on oil prices. And the Saudis feeling threatened by the Iranians. Remember, the Iranians, the Saudis can always play the swing producer. The Saudis have supported this sanction regimen because of the Iranian threat to get a bomb, and the Saudis know darn well they're a target of the Iranians as well. So oil, energy, money, there are a lot of things that are working against the Iranians that are not ostensibly part of this sanction package, but they are ultimately an economic squeeze on the regime. Point about how quickly they can build a bomb. Jim, I think we were on an Instapundit podcast, I want to say in 2008, so it was about 5 years ago, and we were asked how long could they take for the Iranians to put together a bomb. And my memory was it said, 18 to 36 months. In part because of the analysis, Dan, that Jim gave a few minutes ago about all this extra fuel that they're producing. Now, note that they are—they have some extremely competent physicists. They have extremely competent engineers, but there are real problems they have with fabrication. Can I detail them? No. But the fact that they've had the access and the capacity and still have yet, as far as we know, to produce fissionable a bomb. Plus, on top of that, we've talked about Stuxnet and some of the other not so sneaky, including assassination of Iranian nuclear scientists. Probably, it's usually attributed to the Israelis, probably is Mossad, to slow down the program. Their road to a bomb is not easy, but in part it's not easy because of active measures taken by, covert measures by, again, the supposition is generally Israel, but Stuxnet from what I've read, and I know everybody else has read it as well, and made some major U.S. media, that Israel and U.S. and maybe some other folks were involved in Stuxnet as well. It's not a sure thing that they're going to have a bomb within X number of months or X number of years. But after all, just adding all this information for our readers and listeners, Jim's big point is, guess what? They've got so much, no matter what production, fabrication problems they've got, they're eventually going to build a bomb. And that is what their senior leadership believes. That's why they'll, make short-term concessions. That's why they'll let the IAEA inspectors come in and look at certain things and at certain times, because they think ultimately we're going to have one. And no one has the courage to really stop us, meaning attack our facilities and take them out. The Israelis may have the courage, but they don't have, quote-unquote, the capabilities. So that's Jim, you disagree with any of that, or
no? I mean, that's basically it. They just need time and money, and they got all the time in the world, but we've cut off their money.
Now, one of the things I'm just really curious about is why, and it wasn't reported as much as in the U.S. as other places, was why France's nose was bent out of shape over the proposal that was made. Jim, do you have a take on that?
A lot of European countries, especially Russia, don't really believe that Iran would be that much of a threat if they had nukes. They understand that Iran is run by a religious dictatorship, but they also, again, there's an old world and a new world view of, you know, terrorism, and Islamic, you know, culture. The old world, well, let me put it this way. Obviously the old world's been dealing with the Muslims for centuries. So they have a tradition that goes way back, and that's where they're coming from. The new world, again, like I say, most Americans' history, you know, isn't even taught in many, you know, primary schools anymore. We start from a blank page. You know, we are literally the man from Mars, the man from the, you know, the Western Hemisphere. And that man goes in there and looks at things as if they had no past, just what's going on. And he sees a bunch of religious fanatics who often resort to violence. And this is the nuance that Islamic states have had access to this kind of fanaticism in the past. They've used it, but judiciously, and they usually turn it off. You know, when they don't need it, they have no compunctions about suppressing it. They, most recently, well, Iran and Iraq have turned Islamic fanatics, as well as Syria, has turned Islamic fanatics on and off. And when they turn them off, that means a lot of people get killed or they're given, you know, 1 hour warning to get out of the country and don't come back. The Americans, we tend to miss that and we don't trust it. Now, on top of that, you have the Israelis who believe that in this case, the threats are a little different with regard to Israel. In other words, the Iranians make the usual centuries old threats of, you know, Islamic conservatives against the non-Muslim world, you know, yada, yada, yada. We've heard that before. Our ancestors going back generations have heard that before. But with Israel, it's different. I mean, Ahmadinejad, who is now out of power, but he represented a lot of people in senior positions in the Iranian government who really believed this business that we must destroy Israel. And the French and a lot of other Europeans have noticed that, you know, the Arabs have painted themselves into a corner. You know, you can get a lot of Arabs, especially what I call bicultural Arabs, Arabs, say, who have gone to college or just graduate school in the West and are now back, you know, running the family business or whatever in the diplomats for their home country. They can basically look at from both sides. And they will tell you that, yes, things can get out of hand in my home country. While you Westerners are very nicely rational, or at least compared to Arabs, you know, we tend to believe our own fantasies at times, and this can cause problems. And it's always caused problems. That's one reason why the Muslim world, especially the Arab world, is so poor and so backward. You know, when you look at the statistics, they are incredibly backward. You know, they don't translate as many books. They don't educate as many of their, much of their population. They have higher illiteracy rates. And it goes on and on and on and on. And there's a reason for that, and that's part of that reason that they have this different sense of reality. But the French, who have been involved in the Middle Eastern affairs for, going on 1,000 years, so that, again, they have a background, a tradition, as it were, of understanding the Levant. They say, you know, these guys are different. You know, a lot of things are different, you know, in the last couple of centuries. And this latest, you know, strain of Islamic fanaticism is scary. You know, and 9/11 was a wake-up call to a lot of Europeans that, oh, wait a minute, we've never seen that before. You know, the Muslims have, you know, they laid siege to Vienna, which is a big deal. They celebrate that in Europe, you know, because the Christians won. But they took Constantinople, there was the Crusades, et cetera, et cetera. But now they feel that, you know, more and more Europeans are beginning to feel that, you know, if they got a bomb, could we really trust them to keep them away from these people who seem to be seriously intent on destroying Israel? And the Israelis will secretly exchange a lot of very interesting intelligence, both with, you know, countries like the United States, which we have arrangements for, but even like Europe and Britain, and even Saudi Arabia. For example, it's known, it's public, that the Israel has helped save the king of Jordan, not just the current one, but his father, several times by warning them we have detected an assassination attempt. You know, the Jordanian monarchy is probably the most plotted against on the planet, and yet they tend to survive, and it's no accident. They're just very careful about their security. But there have been several occasions where the Israelis provided the tip, which allowed the Jordanians to short-circuit yet another plot against their royal family. And apparently that has been done for the Saudis as well. The Saudis can't acknowledge it as openly as the Jordanians can. But, you know, it's generally, you know, known, as the saying goes, you know, on the street, that the Israelis have been useful, as a euphemism, you know, is that is generally used. So the feeling is, in many parts of Europe, again, for different reasons, the Europeans, again, take this long view. We've dealt with the Muslims, you know, the Moors, or whatever you want to call them, for a long time. They are different. I think we understand them. We know how to deal with them. But there's a feeling that, you know, there are some out there now because of hypermedia and, you know, whatever, you know, frustrate. Actually, there's a civil war going on in the Islamic world, something we've written on a strategy page frequently. So you're seeing more extremism, especially on the conservative end, you know, where the conservatives feel, that their backs are against the wall, that the threat to their fundamentalist attitude towards life and religion is more threatened than it ever has been in the past. They're right, of course. And this is what's happening especially in Pakistan and in Afghanistan, where, again, we've written about this numerous times and we will continue to do so. What's really going on in Afghanistan and Pakistan is a religious revolution among the Pashtun tribes. There's 40 million people living on both sides of the Afghan Pakistan border. They're the largest minority in Afghanistan and generally run the place. They're where the Taliban come from. The Taliban are Pashtun, and there is a vicious war going on for several decades, almost half a century now, between the reformers and the traditionalists. That's why Saudi Arabia doesn't allow any other, you know, churches to be built there, because that is the home of Islam and the source of the most conservative, some of the most conservative ideologies in the Islamic world. Now, the Saudi government tries to play that down because they have to deal with it. They can't suppress it entirely, but they have managed to control it. So a lot of Europeans and a lot of Arabs, you know, Muslims, are beginning to realize that, you know, we have really got a monster here. It's something different from any earlier monster. So now there is less willingness to, you know, make a deal with the devil. Because if the devil has nukes, it's a whole new ballgame. So once more, nuclear weapons have changed the world of war and peace, of diplomacy, because it's a whole new higher level of destruction if somebody makes a mistake and pulls the trigger.
Mm-hmm. Austin, we'll let you wrap this up for us. What are your concluding thoughts?
Well, one last point. Jim gave a great and broad-ranging analysis of both the historical and the, you know, strategic landscape. What I'm about to say, Dan, is speculative. I mean, I've read it. It's out there. It's that the French are aware of the risks. And that Jim just outlined, that they don't believe at all you can trust the current regime in Tehran, and you can't trust them with a nuclear weapon. And there's been something of a reversal going on in the West. Somebody can read this as an attack on the current U.S. administration. I'm just stating this as As fact, it's France, because the U.S. is not in the saying no, the French are saying no, because they know that the Iranians can't be trusted for the reasons Jim outlined. They've also had to deal directly with Iranian-fostered terrorism. Terror attacks that have connections to Iran, more of this went on in the 1990s, but they know where the roots of it are. Remember, too, that there were somewhere between 50 and 60 French paratroopers that were killed in 1983 in Lebanon in an attack that had ties to Iran. The French know that their survival, it may not, they may not have faced the immediate threat that the Israelis do, but they don't understand what kind of long-term threat the Iranians represent, and it's when and where do you act? I said a few moments ago the Iranians don't think anybody except the Israelis really have the will to attack them or the capabilities, but who knows what will emerge, and who knows what kind of mistakes they will make, because they make mistakes as well. So I'll just leave those thoughts.
All right. Well, thank you, gentlemen, and we'll talk to you next time.
Talk to you guys later.
Bye.
Bye.